Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda Calhoun, a member of the club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our very distinguished speaker, Hale Esfandiari. A renowned journalist and scholar, Esfandiari is author of My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. She is also a founder, director of Woodrow Wilson Center's Middle East program. She earned her PhD from the University of Vienna. Esfandiari grew up under Mossack Dah and Mohammad Reza Shah. She lived in Iran until the 1979 revolution forced her to leave the country and settled in the United States. Over the years, she returned to Iran, but during a 2006 visit, she was instructed by officials that she was under security investigation and could not leave the country. She later discovered that the intelligence ministry believed that her scholarly work at the Woodrow Wilson Center was a cover by the U.S. government to overthrow the Iranian regime. She describes her ordeal as a political prisoner in Evin, Iran's most notorious prison, fighting false allegations, solitary confinement, and offers us a candid view of Iran's current and complex relationship with the United States. Please join me in welcoming Hale Esfandiari.
Thank you, Celia. Thank you, Linda, for your kind words. Thank you for coming today. My colleague, Aaron David Miller, is going to be here in 2 weeks' time, and I promise you, you'll be in for a remarkable treat. He is a fantastic speaker and has a lot of interesting things to say. I'm glad that I'm going first and he's coming second. He would have completely overshadowed me. My Prison, My Home is an account of my lengthy interrogation, arrest, and incarceration in Iran at the hands of Iran's intelligence ministry. But it is also something more. I give an account in the book of an Iranian childhood of growing up in the gentler and the simpler Iran of the 1940s and the 1950s. I touch on my working career. I was part of a new generation of Iranian professional women pursuing careers and pressing for more equal rights and our place in society. And I write about the revolution, the havoc it played with some of us, with our lives. And also I write about the current clash between the more reactionary and the reformist ruling class in Iran. I also discuss the expanding authority of Iran's security services and the troubled relationship between Iran and the United States, because these form the background and provide part of the explanation as to why I, on a simple visit to see my 93-year-old mother in Tehran, ended up in solitary confinement, accusing of trying to foment a velvet revolution. In December 2006, I'd gone to visit my mother to spend a week for Christmas with her. On December 30th, 2006, on my way to the airport, I was stopped by a car who just pulled in front of the taxi that was taking me to the airport, and three knife-wielding men jumped out of the car, and one ordered the driver to open the trunk, he took my suitcase, the second one took my carry-on bag, and the third one came and sat next to me on the back seat, and he started going through my purse. I, being very naive, and Tehran being a metropolis of 14 million people, I thought, okay, this is a robbery, bad luck, it happened to me. So I told him, please take everything and just leave me my passport and my ticket because I'm traveling tonight. He just gave me a really very sinister grin and then bent towards me and started going through my pockets. And for a brief moment, this absurd thought occurred to me that in the Islamic Republic, men and women who are strange with each other are not supposed to touch each other and not even sit next to one another. And this strange man is going through my coat pockets. Little did I know that this was the beginning of me being in the company of a strange man, a stranger who became my interrogator for the next 8 months. And it didn't matter that we were together in a small room, he interrogating me and me facing the wall and answering him. The next day, I started going to the passport office and trying to apply for a new passport to be able to leave the country. Within 2 days, I found out that this is not your normal robbery, and I was a victim of the Iranian intelligence ministry, and I was in their hand. And the moment I found out that this is going to be a lengthy period of interrogation, I truly panicked because I knew that once you fall in the hands of the intelligence ministry, it would be very difficult to get rid of them. So for 4 months, I was called in for interrogation almost every day. I would go between 8 and 9, and the interrogation would last 8 hours and 9 hours. The focus of the interrogation outside prison and later on inside prison was on my work at the Wilson Center. And I very soon found out that the intelligence ministry people and some part of the leadership in Iran do not understand the nature of the work of think tanks in Washington, of research centers in this country, of even universities. For them, the Wilson Center, the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, the Brookings Institution, the Hoover Institution, and Princeton and MIT and Harvard, they focused on the Ivy League schools, were all part of the United States government, and they acted as instrument of the United States government. There is a sense of fear in among the leadership in Iran and the sense of concern that Iran is surrounded militarily by the United States. There is a presence, there's a United States military presence in the Persian Gulf, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Central Asia, and then, of course, NATO has a presence in Turkey. So they feel completely surrounded by the United States. They also had convinced themselves, I'm not talking about 207, that the United States being bogged down in Iraq and in Afghanistan was not going to resort to a military attack on Iran. So therefore, they would try to undermine and overthrow the Iranian regime through soft means. And by soft means, they meant the Velvet Revolution, like what we had witnessed in the Ukraine and in Georgia. So they had studied very carefully the developments in those two countries and had convinced themselves that the Soros Foundation was very instrumental in those in promoting the movement that led to the overthrow of the government in the Ukraine and also in Georgia. And so they thought, because the Soros Foundation gives grants to a lot of think tanks and research centers, and including the Wilson Center. So therefore, we were part of that plot. All this discussion between my interrogators, who introduced himself as a Mr. Jafari, and myself, was really just like the theater of the absurd, because they would tell me that you are the mastermind behind this plot. You are planning the overthrow of the Iranian regime. And I would say, you know, me, I mean, I'm barely 5 feet tall. I don't even weigh 105 pounds, and I'm 67 years old. I'm going to overthrow the mightiest regime in the Persian Gulf? I mean, how is that possible? But, you know, this was, we didn't make any headway in these discussions. The interrogations were intimidating, frightening. We went over and over the same subject every day. They wanted to know about all the meetings that the Wilson Center had arranged over the years. And fortunately, we are a very transparent organization. So I would tell them, you can find all your answers on the web. Just go on our website and just read. But the problem was that they were too lazy to do that. So they would ask me to do that. So I would go home around 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock at night, exhausted after spending 8 hours of interrogation, and then send an email to my colleagues at the Wilson Center and ask them to provide me with the list of our meetings, which was on our website, because accessing the internet was terribly slow, so I couldn't do it directly, so they would then send it to me. I would then have to translate it into Persian. So I would be up till 2 in the morning, till 3 in the morning, and then had to be focused the next day to go again through the interrogation. They kept on threatening me that they are not satisfied with what I'm trying to tell them, and my situation will get worse. On the other hand, I would get reassurance from colleagues and friends and family in the United States that, don't worry, they will never dare to take you to prison, because somehow my gut feeling told me that they might take me to prison, they might put me on trial. And but I got these reassurances, which in a way, when you are in a situation like this, when you know you are followed, you know, every day, you know that the card which is following your cab escorting you all the way to the intelligence ministry and escorting you back. And what was puzzling to me is that why they didn't give me a ride, because then at night it was sometimes very difficult to get a cab, you know. It was winter, it was snowy, it was cold in Tehran. I also found out that they were very suspicious of their own NGOs. They were suspicious of American and Europeans, and the Europeans didn't fare any better than the Americans, really, of American universities, American institutions, inviting Iranian scholars, inviting Iranian NGO activists, inviting Iranian journalists to meetings. And I would tell them that, look, in a city like Washington, where, and this was under the previous administration, we are talking about 2007, would tell them, in a city like Washington, when, you know, where there is this sense of animosity towards Iran, it is always better to get people coming from Iran, at least to provide a better image from Iran, because in Iran we have very sophisticated and well-educated professors, scholars, journalists, women activists. So they would come, they would speak, and they were really impressive. But then Mr. Jafari, my interrogator, would interrupt me and would say, no, there is a sinister motive behind inviting these people, and this is to bring them to these meetings and then introduce them to CIA operatives who would then recruit them. And then he would then say, just give us the name of the CIA representatives who come to your meeting. And I would say, look, I mean, you have been interrogating me now for 2 months, and you never gave me your real name. So do you think that someone would walk into a public meeting and would come up to me and say, hello, I'm so-and-so working for the Central Intelligence Agency and I'm here to recruit people? No. But still, it didn't, you know. I mean, the problem was that I was dealing with a bunch of paranoid people who were concerned, worried about really... The approach to Iran through a rainbow revolution, a soft revolution. Finally, I think they decided that they are not making any headway with me outside prison. And on May 8, I was asked to go back to the intelligence ministry. I did, and I was told that by Mr. Jafari, he picked up a piece of paper which I never read, and he said that we are taking you to Evin prison. I said, may I do a phone call? And they said, yes. So I called my mother, and I told her, they're taking me to Evin, just get me a lawyer. And we had arranged that with my husband, who was in the States, that if they take me to prison, he would approach Shirin Ebadi, the Iranian Nobel Peace Prize winner, and then she would ask her to represent me. He did, and she told him, knowing the Iranian system, she told him that they will never let me visit her. They will never let me see her file. But all I can do is to make a lot of noise. So I was booked into Evin, and my interrogation started that afternoon. In Evin, I was blindfolded, and I was put in solitary confinement. Solitary confinement meant no contact with the outside world except with the women guards who were in charge of Ward 209, the women's section of Ward 209, and only your interrogators and nobody else. So for 3 months, for 105 days, I was completely cut off from the rest of the world, and I just didn't know what was going on in the outside world. I was allowed to make a couple of phone calls to my mother, but a woman guard would stand next to me, and I was only allowed to say, how are you, how is my family, what about the grandchildren? And she would say, everybody is fine, we are doing all we can. And I thought, well, this is a mother trying to comfort her daughter. In prison, the interrogation became much harsher, and they signed a warrant to keep me for 4 months under in solitary confinement, with again threatening me that they would be able to renew it maybe to 8 months and even keep me as long as it is necessary, 8 years or more. They also started going over the same kind of questioning, but trying really to force me to confession. They wanted me to implicate the Wilson Center. They wanted me to implicate other people. But the people they wanted me to implicate in this affair, I even didn't know who these people were. And little really did I know that 2 years later, after the current presidential elections in Iran, the leadership of the reform movement would be arrested, put on trial, charged again with fomenting a velvet revolution. And these are people with impeccable revolutionary credentials, you know, people who served as vice president, as members of parliament, as cabinet ministers, terribly loyal to the Islamic Republic. So I thought that once they were done with questioning me, and there was another Iranian-American who was picked up with me, that they would just give up or shelf the idea of the Velvet Revolution. What I did not know is that they continued working on it. In prison, I was Mr. Jafari was joined by his boss, so I had two interrogators. They would take me to interrogation blindfolded, and it was really a very humiliating and debilitating, you know, feeling to be led by someone, you know, a woman at my age hanging on to somebody's arm and making sure that I don't fall down the stairs or I don't hit my head on a wall. But then I developed a system for myself. The moment they put the blindfold and I started to follow either the woman guard or Mr. Jafari, I would just push up a little bit my blindfold so I could see at least the footsteps and make sure I do not fall. I had decided that I should not give in to despair. And one way of not to giving in to despair was to not to think about my family. From the moment I entered my cell, I decided that I'm alone. I don't have anyone in the outside world, because thinking about my family would break me down. And the idea of bringing me to prison was to break me down and make I do what they wanted. So therefore, that was out. And I decided in order to spend, if I was not interrogated, I had to fill in these long days in Evin. In the summer, the sun rises at 5 in the morning and sets around 9 o'clock at night. I didn't have a watch. They took my purse and everything. So I would hear the birds chirping at 5 o'clock in the morning in the prison garden, so I knew it was 5. At 12, they would serve lunch, and in the at 10 o'clock at night, they would bring your medication. I didn't take anything, but I knew that these were the times. So I knew that it was 5 o'clock, it was 12 o'clock, and then 10 o'clock at night. The third time I saw the moon in the sky, I noticed that I've been in Evin for 3 months. I spent my days when I was not interrogated. They took off Thursday, Friday, so we had this. I had this long weekend to myself. I would pace up and down my cell, and I composed 2 books in my mind. I wrote a biography of my paternal grandmother and also a children's story for my grandchildren. I would move chapters, I would move paragraphs, and I did that in my mind. It was a very good exercise for my mind. As for my, and then the rest of the time I would exercise, I would pace up and down the cell, I would do Pilates exercise, I had 2 bottles of water, I would do weightlifting, and the women guard would come to me and say, why don't you sit still? Because while I was moving, it was also disrupting for them, because they had to come and constantly check from that people and to see I'm not doing any harm to myself. While if I was sitting in a corner, that was okay. But I refused to do that. I was given a blanket to sleep on the floor with, and I said, I just can't. I'm too bony to sleep on one blanket, so they gave me more blankets. I lost 20 pounds in 3 months. When I had gone to prison, it was I was weighing 105 pounds. When I left prison, I was weighing 85 pounds. And I'd stopped eating the prison food, and I would just live on vegetable and the fruit that I would just ask the prison shopper to buy for me. Evin is a very strange place because you either ask for a credit card and they give you, or you pay cash. And once a week you can make a list and they go and shop for you. So being the summer, it was I had access to fruit and vegetables. I really felt that my future was completely unknown, and I had prepared myself because of the tone of the interrogation inside prison that they were going to charge me and put me on trial, and I'd prepared myself to just spend probably maybe the next 10 years in Evin prison. Then one afternoon, very suddenly, I was told I can pack and go home. And I thought this was a very cruel joke because they were very good at making these jokes. And so I took my belonging and I walked out. And as I was walking out, my interrogator said, going home to your mother does not mean that you can go back to the States. We are going to keep you here. So I swallowed my tears and walked out and was met by my mother and my cousin who had come to pick me up. And my mother had to put her apartment as bail. I left prison, and 10 days later I got a phone call from Mr. Jafari, who, as I said, was my unwelcome companion for 8 months, and said, you can go and pick up your passport and leave, but leave as soon as you can. And I thought, you know, they kept me for 8 months and now they can't wait to get rid of me. So the process of getting a passport lasted only 2 hours this time. Went in the morning to the passport office. 2 hours later, I had a passport. My American passport was waiting for me in Vienna because I didn't want to risk getting it in Tehran because I thought, what if they take it again? So I left the country and on August 22nd and returned to the United States on... September 2nd and came back to the United States on September 5th. With me in prison, there was another Iranian-American. I was picked up on May 8th. He was picked up on May 9th. His name is Kian Tajbakhsh. He's an urban planner, a sociologist, a fine scholar, devoted Iranian, really. And I had known him for a number of years. He had come to Washington and had given talks. He was picked up with me. We both were forced to appear on camera talk about what we knew. This was the lowest point of my stay in prison. Although when they told me, will you appear on camera, I said, sure, provided I will repeat what I have been telling you. But it's a terrible feeling. You feel dirty, you feel soiled, you feel belittled. And we both separately appeared on camera. The show was broadcast in Iran, but it had the opposite effect they had intended, because when I was when I left prison and I spent 10 days in Tehran, I tried to avoid going out as much as I could because I was worried I would be picked up by another group of the intelligence ministry, because they were already discussing in the newspapers, why did you let her out? If she was not so important, why did you arrest her in the first instance, etc.? Kian was still in jail. So people would come up to me in the street and say, well, we are very proud of you, or there is not that this idea of a velvet revolution is not so bad, it's not violent. So, but unfortunately, Kian was picked up after the recent presidential elections, and this time he was put on trial, and last week he was sentenced to... 12 years and more, we don't know what more means, of prison. So please do remember him. In my case, the international uproar helped, and I'm sure in his case it will help again. Thank you.
Our thanks to Hale Esfandiari, author of My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran, for her comments here today. I'm Linda Calhoun, a member of the club's International Relations Forum, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. But before we begin that, since we have the author here, I asked if she would be so kind as to read a passage from her book.
Sure. So.
And we'd like to...
Sorry, shall I?
Yes, please.
I'm going to read you the passage in the book about Evin, when I was first taken. We stopped at what happened, what appeared to be a door, the entrance to Ward 209. I could hear the guard ring a doorbell, push open the door, then pull back a curtain. We stepped inside. The guard told me to remove the blindfold. I was standing in a corridor roughly 50 feet long and barely 5 feet wide, with windows on my right and iron cell doors painted white on my left. The guard walked me to the last of the doors, which was open. This was the entrance to my cell. She motioned me to go in. She emptied my bag, made a list of the contents, and took away everything, even my watch and hand cream, leaving me only my reading glasses and my hairbrush. Two other female guards had come to the door for a look at the new arrival. One was in her 20s, the other in her mid-40s. They soon left. I heard the door swing shut, then heard the click of the lock as it fell into place. A quiet click that echoed in my head like thunder. I looked at my new home. The room was bare but clean. The walls were painted a greenish yellow with patches of white where the paint had peeled off. Against one wall stood a dirty iron sink. Well-worn, brown, wall-to-wall carpet covered the floor. In one corner, there was a single folded blanket and a copy of the Quran. There was no bed or toilet. About 8 feet up on one of the walls were two rectangular windows that looked out onto a flat roof. They were open to let in fresh air, screened to keep out flies, and barred to keep in prisoners. Fixed to the high ceiling were two sets of bright fluorescent lights. They remained turned on day and night.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate that reading. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to a program with Hale Esfandiari. We have a number of large number of questions, so we'll begin. How has the role for women in Iran changed since the revolution? And do you see women playing a larger role in the future?
The Iranian women are really the only group in Iran who have stood up for 30 years to the government. They have fought for, again, the last 30 years to gain back the right they lost after the revolution. One of the most important decisions that was taken by the Islamic Republic was the suspension of the family protection law, which gave the right of divorce to women, the right to the child custody was given to the mothers. The age of marriage was 18, among other things. And after the revolution, the family protection law was suspended. So as a result, men once again got the unilateral right to divorce their wives. The age of marriage was reduced from 18 to 9 for girls because it's puberty in Islam. It was raised to 13, I believe, 7 years ago. But this does not mean that Iranian girls are married off at the age of 13. The mean age of marriage for women is now around 20, but the law says 13. And so when the law says 13, if a father decides to marry off his daughter at the age of 13, the law protects him. Child custody was taken away from the mother and was given to the father, but recently it was changed, so it's the court who decides who has the right to gain the custody of the children. And all these changes happened because the Iranian women had brought a lot of pressure on the government. We have women sitting in parliament. We have a woman minister for the first time in 30 years. I mean, before the revolution, we had two women ministers in Iran. Now there is Mr. Ahmadinejad nominated three women to his new cabinet. Parliament rejected two, approved one, despite the opposition of the more traditional cleric in Qom, and also the opposition of a number of members of Parliament in his own party. So for the first time, there is a woman minister. She's the Minister of Health, a very conservative person who, when she was a member of Parliament, was talking about passing a bill segregating medical care for women and men, but the bill was never put in for discussion because they didn't have enough female doctors to take care of women. In 2006, a number of women and men got together and started the campaign to collect 1 million signatures to promote equal right for women in the Islamic Republic. Over the last 3 years, a number of these the leaders of the campaign, both men and women, especially women, have been arrested, taken to prison. So when I was in prison, they would bring in these campaign leaders. I never saw them, but later on when I was released, I heard that the campaign women who were taken to prison knew about my presence in prison.
Great, thank you. In many ways, your work with the Woodrow Wilson Center served as the cover or the excuse to interrogate and hold you. Can you just explain for all of us here what is the work of the Woodrow Wilson Center and what you've done with them?
The Woodrow Wilson Center is a nonpartisan institution in Washington. It was named after President Wilson, the only president with a PhD in the United States. It brings the word of idea, you know, the words of idea with the words of the practitioners together. We, at the Wilson Center, we organize on the average 800 meetings a year covering the whole world. We have a number of programs. I'm in charge of the Middle East program. We have an Africa program, an Asia program, a United States program, the Kennan Institute for Russian Studies, the Mexico program, the International Security program. So we, what we do as a nonpartisan institution, in our meetings, we bring people from different and opposition point of views, and we arrange for them a discussion, and really we promote understanding between various position and point of views.
Great. As I hear your explanation, and as we were listening to your talk, you touched upon this notion of paranoia. And hearing you talk about that gives us some insight into the crackdown and the reaction that happened after the elections. Is there any additional insight you have in terms of, you know, what you experienced in 2006, 2007, and what ultimately happened after the recent elections?
I think my experience in 2007 was an experience of an individual, mm-hmm. you know. But I think what has happened since the presidential elections, I mean, it is going after not only the leadership of the Reformist Party, which was the opposition in the presidential, during the presidential campaign, but they have gone after ordinary people who had come and protested the manipulation of the elections, the result of the elections, and thousands of people were arrested, and some have been tortured, and some have died, and so there has been a violation of human rights, and I'm just repeating what former presidential candidates are saying. It's not my take on right. these things. I mean, I'm quoting Mr. Karoubi, the former Speaker of Parliament, quoting Mr. Mousavi, the former prime minister of Iran, who have made these allegations and accusations. There have been these mock trials, and the former president, Khatami, said that these trials reminds one of the Stalinist period in the Soviet Union. The situation in one of the detention centers was so appalling that Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, ordered the closure of that detention center.
In your opinion, what percentage of the Iranian people support the Islamic Republic?
That's a tough question, and I really don't like to get into speculation, but I'm sure that there is quite maybe a substantial number of people, the people who voted for Mr. Ahmadinejad, and I wish we knew the exact figures in these elections, are supporter of him and I would say the regime. Sure. Okay. But let me also add that my take of the presidential election was that those who came out in the streets, and there were millions of them, did not want a revolution. They basically wanted an evolution. They wanted an opening up of the system. They wanted reaching out to the outside world. So that was their aim. I don't think they were after overthrowing the regime.
Are you still a citizen of Iran?
Oh, sure.
Okay. And will you consider returning to Iran?
When I left Iran in September 2nd, 2007, and usually planes leave for Europe around between 12 and 3 in the morning, I looked out of the window and looked at the sea of light, which was Tehran, and I looked out and I said, okay, this is not goodbye, this is so long, so I hope to be able to go back.
In your book, you talked about some of the similarities between what was going on with the intelligence ministry, Jafari, and the questions that he was asking you, and the East German Stasi. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
I studied in Austria, and so I was very much interested in what was going on in then East Germany, and started reading a number of books about how the security people would work in East Germany and the line of questioning and so on, just as novels and so on. So I studied it. And so when they started their line of questioning, it reminded me of the Stasi and what I had read about them.
Are there any sanctions that can be imposed on Iran to slow down its nuclear program that would not hurt unnecessarily the Iranian people?
Engaging Iran, I think, is I believe that it is necessary to engage Iran, because I look back and see decades of isolating Iran, demonizing Iran, imposing sanctions on Iran did not help. I mean, the nuclear clock started ticking when Iran was isolated, demonized, when sanctions were imposed on Iran. Iran built its missile program in the last decade. Iran made extraordinary progress in its nuclear program, again under sanction. So I have always been for engagement, but currently I think the Obama administration is having a brilliant approach to Iran, and engaging Iran now does not mean ignoring the violation of human rights. When you discuss nuclear issues, you have to bring up also the problem of the violation of human rights.
And should Americans be afraid? I mean, I sense there's a lot of fear of Iran's plans for the Middle East.
I just personally don't think that the United States, the mightiest power in the world, should be afraid of Iran. I think if there is a sense of concern, it is among the Persian Gulf countries rather than the United States. And Iran has decent relations with its with the Persian Gulf countries, and it has, you know, it has a presence in Iraq, and I think it can help a lot in stabilizing the situation in Afghanistan. But I don't think Iran is going to give up its support of Hamas, and it's not going to give up its support of Hezbollah.
Do you think the present Iranian regime would ever bomb Israel?
This regime?
Mm-hmm.
No. No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, they are very pragmatic people in Iran, and I mean, they may sound as if they are extremists, but they will never do that, because they know that if they, you know, they will be obliterated, and why should they commit suicide? Absolutely not.
Okay. Here's a question from one of our audience members. Does the fact that the U.S. Congress allocated $400 million for regime change has cast a greater suspicion on NGOs and think tanks?
Sure. I should have mentioned this, that allocating $75 million to promote democracy in Iran created a lot of difficulties for Iranian NGOs and Iranian civil society groups on the ground. And I recall every time we had a meeting at the Wilson Center, and people would come, NGO activists or civil society activists would come to the center and give public talks, they would always say that we really don't want to have anything to do with that money, because it's going to create more problem for us.
I see. And getting back to your more personal story, can you talk a little bit more about how the guards treated you at Evin, and the food? I mean, were you able to make human connections, personal connections?
Yes. Okay. You know, but I was the longest inmate in Ward 209 under solitary confinement, because all the other women who were probably women activists would just walk in and out of prison. So I was there. If you are somewhere, you know, for 105 days, you're bound to establish some sort of relation with them, but they were really following their orders. I mean, they probably were told that there is so much they can talk with me and not more, or with any other inmate. But on the whole, the women guards were terribly nice to me, and because they noticed that I was not eating prison food, one of the women guards was on duty three days a week, would always bring fresh bread for me. I mean, but she would never say, this is for me. She would say, well, I brought fresh bread for my colleagues and the other inmates, and this is a piece for you. And I recall I would exchange recipes with her. You know, there was nothing else to talk about, so we exchanged the recipes. I stopped eating meat in prison, and she was a vegetarian. So and then one day she made one of the recipes I had told her, and she came to prison and she said, please, this is for you for lunch. So I was very touched. Another time, a woman guard walked in and handed me a white rose. So
beautiful.
That was very touching.
You're listening to a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and we are interviewing Hale Esfandiari, author of My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. Your story has a similarity to Kafka's trial. Did you ever feel as hopeless as a Kafka victim?
No. No, really, I just, of course, there are, you know, similarities. You start remembering books you have read and so on. But no, it was unique to what happens in Iran, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remembered more stories that I had read about prisoners before and after the revolution. And also, Linda, let me tell you that if you are being interrogated every day, you need to be very focused. Mm-hmm. So starting thinking about other things is really a luxury you cannot allow yourself. And after I would return from interrogation, I would repeat to myself what they asked, what I answered, and sort of just like a chess player to think what is going to be the next movement, tomorrow, and what are they going to ask me. But at some stage in prison, I had access to books. Kian Tajbakhsh, who lived in Iran, was receiving books from home. So we got a permission from Mr. Jafari that he could send me some books. So I would spend 2 hours every night to reading books. But I have macular degeneration, and they refused to give me my medication. So I had to be very parsimonious with using my eyes, and especially since I had to answer their questions in writing, so I would spend, you know, too many hours putting things on paper.
Wow. Halle, we are at the point in the program where there's time for just one last question, and your family was very established in Iran. And it was quite a joy to read about your family background in the book. And as I hear how you sustained yourself through this ordeal, can you reflect on what qualities or strengths you got from your family to be able to withstand this ordeal?
We are a very close-knit family. My cousin is in the audience with his wife, and I'm sure they drove quite a bit to get here, so it shows how close-knit and loving family we are. During my ordeal, really, in Iran, I got a lot of support from my family, because what was really hurting was that a lot of friends suddenly disappeared from the radar. And I don't blame them, because there is a sense of fear if you live in an autocratic regime, but the people who stood by me were my family. And, we grew up as an extended family, so there was this network which gives you a backbone to face difficulties in your life. And also, I must say that I have a very loving husband and a loving daughter, and whenever I wanted to console myself in prison, I would say, look, you're 67 years old, you had a wonderful life, so what? They take it away. That's how I do.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Our thanks to Halle Esfandiari, author of My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran, for her comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.